Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. I'm here under Husky Stadium with Dr. Kim Harmon, who is head of sports medicine at the University of Washington and professor of family medicine and orthopedic surgery and sports medicine. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So today I mainly wanted to talk to you about non-surgical approaches to sport-related degenerative joint and tendon problems, because that's something you have considerable experience in. But before we get into that, maybe you can talk a bit about your background and training and what it is you do from day to day.
So I'm a primary care sports medicine doctor, which means that I did a family medicine residency and then did a sports medicine fellowship. And so that's extra training in sports medicine. I've been here at the University of Washington for 20 years and have an interest in keeping people on the field, specifically sort of overuse injuries, tendinopathy, and arthritis, early arthritis.
So that's something that we get a lot of questions about, including some of the treatments that you use, like platelet-rich plasma, which hopefully we'll really dig into. But can you talk a little bit about how these injuries or problems occur? Like, what are the underlying processes? How do they happen over time?
So I think it's easiest to sort of divide it in between tendons and arthritis. And so with tendons, I think of tendons like big cables made up of a bunch of little wires. And we're always breaking that wire down. And the body's designed to make new wire. And so like you break down a muscle on purpose to make it stronger, a tendon really should respond to the stresses that you put on it. But sometimes a tendon isn't as biologically active as muscle or even bone. And so sometimes that process breaks down. And so the tendon doesn't actually have time to recover. And so it gets into this sort of chronic degenerative phase. And sometimes it, after a while, just sort of gets tired and decides to quit trying to fix itself. And that's where you get into problems with chronic tendinopathy. And this is a little bit different than if you go out and you play tennis or volleyball or basketball, whatever, and you overuse something to the point that there's an inflammatory response, which is the first stage of healing, and then your body fixes it. It's sort of like your own intrinsic sort of healing mechanisms sort of poop out and don't work.
And what underlies some of that in terms of how that chronic tendinopathy process comes into being? Is it the wrong kind of loading? Is it problems with blood flow or nutrient delivery or all of the above?
Yeah, I think it's more like all of the above. And even more basic than that, each of us probably have an inherent tendon sort of ability to sort of recover. And so we'll see people that really get into a lot of problems with tendinopathy from one place to the other place. And it's probably just that they don't have as good a tendons as the next guy. And so they can thank their parents for that.
Do you have any way of figuring out who might be at greater risk for that kind of stuff?
Not right now, but I think at some point we would be able to look at somebody's genome and see who are people that are more likely to develop tendon problems. And then that might inform the way that you train.
So then what kind of problems are you seeing in the clinic in terms of the day-to-day people that come into your practice?
So I see a lot of runners with chronic Achilles tendinopathy. And in that same runner category, we also see proximal hamstring tendinopathy. So right there where the hamstring attaches into the rear end, that can be a big problem too. We see patellar tendinopathy or in the knee, particularly with jumpers, and then a lot of shoulder problems. The plantar fascia is really sort of like a flat tendon, and so we see that a lot. And then we'll see smaller tendons too, like some of the smaller tendons in the foot and the ankle, the peroneal tendons, the posterior tibialis tendons, the elbow tendons, both on the inside and the outside. So that's tennis elbow and golfer's elbow. And so sort of any place that you've got a tendon, which is, of course, a structure that's hooking the muscle to the bone, you can get into problems with overuse in it. And then we like to try and help you out.
And what about the joints? We obviously separated tendons out from joint problems, but are you also seeing various arthritides, osteoarthritis, and stuff like that?
Yeah. So we most often see knees and hips, but we also see ankles and shoulders. And when golfers will sometimes see the little joints in the hand. But knees and hips are the big issue that we see here in the sports clinic.
So then maybe talk about how you approach from the assessment, somebody coming in, to then thinking about how you might intervene as, say, the severity of the disease increases.
So when people first develop problems with tendons, the first thing that you want to look at is sort of actually, have they had enough time to have the body recover itself? And so Mother Nature is a pretty powerful thing. And sometimes it's just a matter of, you just need to give your body a chance to sort of catch up to what you've done to it. And so to make sure that people have had adequate rest, that they're training adequately, and that sort of thing. You can try things like Tylenol and the anti-inflammatories. By the time people get to see me, usually the issue isn't acute inflammation that the anti-inflammatories will affect. And they can be helpful, but they tend to be more just pain relievers than actually really doing anything to fix the problem. We might send people to the physical therapist who will look more at maybe loading the tendon in a specific way. So trying eccentric exercises using the muscle as it's elongating. So when you do that to a tendon, it appears that that causes the tendon to make growth factors. And so that can stimulate a healing repair. And so doing something like eccentric exercises is probably a first step when you get to the doctor, if you haven't tried that already.
And can you do that for things like the plantar fascia? Is it possible to do eccentric loading?
Well, the fascia is a fascia because it's not really attached to any muscles. And so that is actually the one sort of thing that you can't really do eccentric exercises for. Some of the other tendons, it's more challenging to do it, but you can figure out how you use that muscle to make it contract and then to make it lengthen. And you want to have it lengthen against tension, and that seems to promote growth factors.
That's actually the step that I think most people, both those first steps you mentioned, seem to be the ones that people miss. First is that they don't actually give enough time for the body to heal. And then if they do, if they're given, so say, Achilles tendinopathy in runners, you tell people to do those sort of the resisted calf raises or eccentric loading against calf raises, something like that, to work the Achilles tendon. And that's always something that people never really try that hard to do. They just sort of like think, oh, well, it's not really a problem. They don't really fix it. That seems to be where most people get stuck.
So you want to sort of do the first things first. And once you get to the point where your tendon is sort of broken down, I mean, it takes 6 to 12 weeks to grow a new tendon. And so it's not going to fix itself overnight, but you do want to give eccentric exercises a trial. And other things I think that are more early intervention in terms of tendon issues is some things like either ASTIM or Graston, which are physical therapy techniques where you basically take tools and rub it on the tendon real hard. So that can actually stimulate the tendon to heal. And it's the same principle as the eccentric exercises. It's putting some pressure on the tendon and causing it to excrete growth factors. In Europe and Canada, they use extracorporeal shockwave therapy, which is blasting sound waves at the tendon. And that's that same mechanotransduction principle that can cause a tendon to start this healing process. We don't find that very much here in the United States because insurance companies don't pay for it. And the sort of equipment for somebody to buy it is too expensive to get a good return on investment. So even though there seems to work in Canada and Europe, apparently here it doesn't here in the United States, or it's less available here. And so those are sort of early things that you can do. The other step that gets skipped a little bit is probably something called nitro patches. And so those are nitroglycerin patches that are an old blood pressure medication. We don't use it very much for blood pressure anymore, but nitrous oxide is a growth factor. So on tendons that are near the surface, so like the Achilles tendon, on the patellar tendon on the knee or on the elbow tendons, you can put this nitrous oxide patch on it and you wear it actually for 23 hours a day, essentially all the time. And that can also sort of stimulate the tendon to heal. And those are all things that can be done before we start sticking needles into a tendon and doing mean things to it.
How long can you do that for? Because I'm thinking, I used to work on a specialist hypertension team when I worked in hospital, and particularly with anything that stimulates nitric oxide production, you adapt to it. So you either need higher doses or you need to take it away for periods of time. So how do you kind of cycle that kind of thing?
So when you're using this for blood pressure, and you're right, you do get an adaptation because the blood vessels get used to it. And so instead of dilating, which is what the nitrous oxide does to the tendon, then they just say, oh, we're sort of used to this being around. They go back to their sort of previous state. But we're not actually using it for the blood vessel dilation. We're using it's a direct effect onto the tendon cells itself. And so you don't see that tachyphylaxis or the getting used to it that you do when you're using it for blood pressure. So whenever I write a prescription for this, the pharmacist all freak out and call me because they're like, you can't wear this more than 12 hours a day, which you can't if it's going to work for blood pressure. But we're not using it for blood pressure. We're using it as a direct growth factor effect on the tendon so they can do that. The problem is probably about 10 to 20% of people can't really tolerate the medication because they get headaches. And it's probably just because of 0.2 of a blood pressure drop. People say hydrated, sometimes you can avoid that. But there's some people that just get headaches with this and can't use it.
And then I know people listening to this are going to think about, what about all the other things that athletes sometimes do to try and boost nitric oxide production? So arginine, citrulline, dietary nitrates, do any of those have an effect, or is that too systemic compared to the localized effect that you want?
It may, but I haven't seen any literature or any evidence that theoretically it's a very sort of interesting or compelling sort of thought, but I don't know of any evidence that that might work. So it probably wouldn't be my first choice.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about sunlight can have a direct effect of creating nitric oxide when it hits the skin. So maybe you just sunbathe with your Achilles tendons out in the sunlight.
And yes, or we can all go to sunny places.
Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. What about the next step? So we've tried all of this. People have made a real effort to do the exercises. You know, maybe we've tried some Grassland technique or some physical therapy, but that still doesn't work. What's sort of next in line in terms of therapy?
Usually I think of a couple different options. So one thing that you can do is something called a tenotomy. And that basically means that we numb up the tendon and we use a big needle and poke the heck out of it with the holes. And the idea is really that you're injuring the tendon, making the body pay attention to it and say, oh my gosh, that tendon's injured down there. I better go fix it. Some people have success with that. You can take that a step further. You can actually go and inject whole blood into the tendon. And so there's growth factors in blood, and injecting into the tendon can restart the healing process. And then taking that one step further, you can take blood out of somebody's arm, spin it down, take just the platelets out of it, concentrate the platelets, and put the platelets back in. And that's what platelet-rich plasma is. And that's where all the growth factors are in the blood, or a lot of them are. So that can re-stimulate the healing process.
So let's dig into platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, which is something that you've researched yourself, written a few papers on. You sort of mentioned that the growth factors are in there. Can you talk a little bit about just how this is used, how it's been researched? Are there specific tendons or joints where it's more successful for? Like, who's it going to be most suitable to?
So again, platelet-rich plasma is not a quick fix because you're trying to grow new tendon. And so it is most appropriate for people who have tried some of the other things that we talked about and it hasn't worked. So the tendons that we use platelet-rich plasma in are really anything that we can reach with a needle. The key, I think, really is that when you're putting anything into a tendon, it needs to be in the right spot. So if you look at a tendon under ultrasound, which is the easiest way to evaluate that in the office, you can see bad spots in that tendon. So when you're putting platelet-rich plasma, it needs to be into the bad spots or else it's not going to work. You can put cortisone sort of just in the general vicinity of things and it will work because there's a systemic effect to it and it also sort of travels through tissue planes. But PRP or blood will sort of clot and begin to work right where you put it. And so it has to be in the right spot. So anybody that's thinking about platelet-rich plasma should probably have it done under ultrasound guidance or else it may be a waste of their time and money because it's not going to do anything if it's not in the right spot. So I think that that's a key. And having said that, anything that we can reach with a needle and see with the ultrasound, we can put platelet-rich plasma in.
So pretty much every tendon where you might regularly see these kind of sports-related injuries, so all the ones you talked about, are there studies to show that it does work?
So there's lots of studies that show that it works. There's some studies that show that it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem with doing research on this is your platelets are different than my platelets. You may have more or less, and then we concentrate them. So if you have, say, 100,000 platelets and I have 300,000 platelets and we concentrate it sort of five times, I've got a lot more platelets than you do. The other thing is what's in your platelets is different from day to day and week to week. So if this is a particularly stressful week for you, you may have bad platelets or not platelets that aren't quite as good. And so comparing what platelet-rich plasma does in me compared to you may be two different things entirely because our PRP is different. So having said that, when you look sort of at the big picture, platelet-rich plasma tends to improve pain and function in people when everything else has worked. A lot of this research is done on not the easy cases, but on the really hard cases. And what we've seen in our own research here at the University of Washington is that when we look at tendons that really, they've failed multiple courses of physical therapy. Most of them had cortisone at some point. They've tried some of the other things that we've talked about. It's still not working. And we do platelet-rich plasma. We get 60% of people mostly or completely better by 6 months. And that's a long time. And then another 20% better over the 6 months after that. And there's probably 20% of people that just don't respond. And so it's not a magic bullet and it's not super quick either. And so when I'm thinking about my elite athletes, we time platelet-rich plasma. So we may try to get people through the end of the season or through a particular event. and then do platelet-rich plasma when we have at least 6 to 12 weeks to recover. So that doesn't mean you have to stop exercising during that whole time, but you're going to have to back off and sort of change what you're doing. And it depends what tendon you're using, and everybody heals differently too. And so it's also sort of a little bit of an art in terms of adjusting people's activity so that they do enough activity to continue to stimulate the healing, but not enough to inhibit it.
How long might you expect to see an improvement for? Is it something that if you actually cause the healing of the tendon such that you want it, that actually you'll be fine as long as you don't start to injure it again? Or is it something where you might need to go back in again in the future?
Typically, when tendons get better with this, they're better. You fixed it. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't go out there and run and run and run, or cycle and cycle and cycle and sort of overextend your capacity again. But most of the time, the vast majority of the time, once we get these things fixed, we don't see people back again.
Oh, that's very cool. You mentioned cortisone along the way, and that's obviously something that people with chronic joint issues may have had exposure to or heard about previously. Is it something that you would try before platelet-rich plasma, or like what might differentiate between when you would use the two different approaches?
Speaking specifically about tendons, so I think of cortisone as sort of game time. So if I've got somebody that says, I have this really important tennis match this weekend and I need to play, cortisone typically improves people pretty quickly. The problem is cortisone is catabolic, or it eats up tissue, and it also tends to stop working. And so I think cortisone is sort of getting me a window. And so usually when you do use cortisone in tendinopathy, you get about a 3 to 6 month window where people are improved. Now, sometimes people's elbows or knees or whatever hurt too bad that they can't do proper rehab. And so if you use cortisone, it can give them a window where they can do some rehab and get the tendon better. But it is rare that cortisone actually gets the tendon better. In fact, most tendons are a little bit worse off after you use cortisone. I say that cortisone is like a gun. It's not good or bad. It's sort of how you use it. And so you need to be very strategic about how you use it. Sometimes it's worth trying cortisone, because if it works and it gives you a long-term result, that's great. Because when you start moving on to platelet-rich plasma, it's a longer haul. The other thing is cortisone is typically covered by insurance, and platelet-rich plasma and things like that aren't. And so sometimes I'm like, well, you should just try it and see if it works. And if it does, great. And if it doesn't, we've still got these other options in our back pocket.
So then can you talk a little bit about how you build this into a general recommendation for your athletes? So say cortisone, it's a game day thing. They need to get out on the field. How does that fit into the bigger picture in terms of their long-term health? Do you have to counsel people as to whether actually maybe they shouldn't be trying to get back out there and shouldn't be trying to just sort of get on top of the pain so they can keep playing? Like, how often do you have to have those kinds of conversations?
All the time. Yeah. And so we talk about the risk and benefits, and it's sort of a shared decision-making process. And so most of the time with cortisone, when you sort of give somebody cortisone so that they can play in the big game or the big match or whatever, most of the time that doesn't really present to them any long-term risk. It may make their tendinopathy worse sort of in the short term. And so it's a longer road to come back from. But usually it doesn't give you any sort of longer term risk. And there's a couple exceptions to that. Achilles tendons tend to rupture. And so you don't really want cortisone around them at all or in them. And yeah. So I am very hesitant and actually scared to use cortisone around the Achilles tendon. The other tendon that we tend not to use it around is a patellar tendon, which is the other tendon that ruptures. Some of the other ones are much less likely to rupture, and it's probably just more of a matter of a longer road to sort of get back to healthy.
And having covered all of this for tendons, how does that change if you're thinking about the actual joint itself?
So when you're thinking about the joint, first I like to start by thinking about the sort of pathogenesis or the cause of arthritis or what that is, because some of us really don't have a great understanding of that. So you've got in a knee, say, you've got two types of cartilage. You've got the meniscal cartilage, which are the sort of cushioners between the two knee bones. And then you've also got articular surface cartilage, or that gliding surface cartilage. And when that gliding surface cartilage starts to wear away, that's what arthritis is. And there's cartilage cells in there. And as those cartilage cells die, they let out a lot of toxic chemicals that then go and bind to the joint lining. And the joint lining makes some more bad chemicals that go and kill more cartilage. And so you start this sort of downward cycle. And as your joint lining is busy making some of these bad chemicals, it doesn't make good things like lubricants and that sort of stuff. And so when we're using platelet-rich plasma in knees or joints instead of tendons, what we're actually trying to do is use the growth factors that are in those platelets to block some of those breakdown products and stop the cycle from happening. And also some of the growth factors in the platelet plasma go and bind to the joint lining and make good things like hyaluronic acid, which sounds awful, but it's actually a really nice lubricant, and you have that in healthy joints. And so with platelet-rich plasma, it's not going to grow people new cartilage, but it improves pain and function. And there's lots of good evidence that it does improve pain and function in the vast majority of people. And it may sort of halt or slow the progression of arthritis. And unlike tendons, platelet-rich plasma in joints, it usually wears off, usually somewhere around a year. And the worse somebody's joint is, the less well it works. And so I talked about the biochemical changes that happen with arthritis in a joint, but there's also biomechanical changes. And so as that cartilage surface wears off, the bone underneath it reacts and gets irritated. And as it reacts, it will grow. And so you get an uneven surface and you get bone spurs. And so once the bony changes happen in arthritis, even if you retread it, it's like retreading a bad tire. It's not going to be super successful.
And then are there any other options for people who have joints that are in that bad condition? Or is that once you get to a point where you can't control it anymore, you then have to think about replacement?
Well, there tends to be a huge, huge gap between when people are ready for replacement and when their knees start to hurt or joints start to hurt and sort of give them problems. And usually that gap is like 20 years. Yeah. And we really don't have a ton of great options for that period to keep people active and moving around. I mean, most joint surgeons would consider that you should get a joint replacement so that you're joints or knees don't hurt anymore, not so that you can continue to run marathons or ski yeah. or climb mountains. And most of my patients, the reason they want their joints fixed is not so they can sit on the couch and watch TV, but so that they can do what they do. So we really need to develop more options. So other options that are out there, so there's something called viscosupplementation that's out there, and there's different brands of it. So Synvisc, Orthovisc, Euflexa, Suprax. There's a number of different options. And what that is that's basically this hyaluronic acid that I talked about. You inject it into the knee, and there it continues to act as a lubricant, but it breaks down pretty quickly. This is actually sold and marketed as a device, but it really has a drug effect because it goes and binds to the joint lining and gets the joint lining to make more of your own native hyaluronic acid. And when you look at studies that compare platelet-rich plasma and this viscosupplementation stuff together, the platelet-rich plasma usually performs a little bit better, but they both cause improvements in pain and function. And I have some patients that respond better to one or the other. The other issue is cost. And so viscosupplementation became FDA approved in the 90s, and insurance companies paid for it for a long time. And about 2 years ago, they sort of stopped paying for it in most people. And there are still some plans that do pay for it, and actually Medicare pays for it. And the stuff itself is pretty expensive, and so it's limited some people's options. And platelet-rich plasma is actually usually cheaper than buying this drug from the drug company and then injecting it. And so I usually try platelet-rich plasma first, unless it's covered by somebody's insurance, and then I do that first. And in Europe, some people will combine them. It's hard to say. Again, it's hard to do research on this and sort of see what works best and what the best protocol is on this. But they're both different options that you can have to try and keep people going. Cortisone is another one. Cortisone actually just gets rid of the chemicals that make it hurt, doesn't really improve the joint milieu. And it can be a decent option, but it tends to stop working. So the first time you may get 6 months or a year of relief of pain from it. And then the second time, 3 or 6 months, and then it's not really worthwhile to do the injection. And it is a little bit hard on that cartilage. And so it's not something that you want to inject 5-10 times into a joint, because it could actually have a detrimental effect on the joint.
So in terms of all the things that are out there, maybe you see being recommended to people or clinics offering to people, is there anything that really makes you sort of roll your eyes in terms of, oh, you know, that's not going to work, or that's going to be a waste of people's money? You know, are there any things that people need to be wary of in terms of something that might be being sold to them that isn't going to work?
Yeah, I see a lot of advertisements right now for stem cells, and stem cells can mean a lot of different things. And so one sort of category of stem cells, I'm doing sort of air quote here, are the amniotic products. And so a lot of people are injecting different derivatives from placenta or amniotic fluid and advertising them as stem cells. And they, in fact, do have stem cells in them, but the stem cells are all dead because they've been irradiated. And so those actual stem cells aren't going to do anything. And the FDA is actually after clinics that advertise in this way. In those amniotic products, there are growth factors in them. And so people may get benefit from the growth factors in them, but I'm not sure that the sort of cost benefit to the growth factors in an amniotic product versus the growth factors in platelet-rich plasma, because the amniotic product tends to be a lot more expensive than PRP. And so I don't have a problem with the amniotic product per se, but when it's advertised as stem cells, that seems disingenuous and people probably aren't getting what they think they're getting. There's other stem cells out there too. The other two sources of stem cells that we use here in the United States are bone marrow aspirate and then fat aspirate. We can't do a lot of processing here in the United States on these. And so, again, this is difficult to do research on because everybody is different. And so, again, my stem cells are different than your stem cells. The number of stem cells in bone marrow goes down precipitously after somebody is 2 years old, and there's not a lot of children that are getting these. And certainly after people are 50, it goes way down. So how many stem cells you can always get? I think of the sort of the bone marrow aspirate as sort of supercharged platelet-rich plasma. And it probably does work better than platelet-rich plasma. Whether typically it is exponentially expensiver than platelet-rich plasma. And so people have to think about sort of the cost benefit and with that, but it's not a panacea. And anybody that's telling you that sort of 90% of people get better or significantly better, you might want to take that with a grain of salt and understand what you're getting into.
So there are a huge number of people now talking about stem cells for, so I mean, obviously this is a one specific example, but then various kind of longevity benefits and all those kinds of things. Are you saying that actually due to the regulations, there isn't that much processing or anything that can really be done with these? So a lot of those potential benefits are really being oversold.
Right. So most people would think that if you're going to really get the benefits of stem cells, that they need to be expanded. And we can't even come close to expanding them here in the United States. So you can spin fluid that has stem cells around it. But other than that, you can't do much to them. Even when you have fat aspirate, you can't even digest the fat to get the stem cells out of it. So you really have difficulty sort of getting enough good quality ones. And so I think there's a ton of potential to stem cells. And some of the stuff that we're doing may have benefit, but the cart's a little bit ahead of the horse on this one. So it's really exciting, but probably not ready for mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything in terms of that whole spectrum of how you might approach somebody with a joint or tendon disease in terms of other therapies that are worth trying, things we haven't talked about, or other supplements or things outside of that you wouldn't necessarily prescribe but you might recommend to people? Is there anything else that's maybe worth talking about?
You know, I mean, I think we've covered most of the stuff that's really sort of reasonable, and particularly for arthritis, it's not that many, right?
Yeah.
So what the American College of Rheumatology recommends for arthritis is sort of Tylenol, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, and that's really not changing the process, just covering it up, maybe bracing or physical therapy. Now, physical therapy isn't going to do anything for arthritis, but it can change your biomechanics, maybe to unload your joint or things like that, but like intrinsically, it's not going to change that arthritic process. So there's not a whole bunch of options out there. Oh, I know. I just thought of one. One thing that you can do, maybe particularly with knee arthritis, that is sort of between that stage before you want to get your knee replaced and maybe some of this other stuff isn't working. So there's some people that are actually doing ablations of the nerve that go down there. And so it's not fixing anything except it allows you to continue to function because that pain inhibition's not there. Maybe put your knee replacement off indefinitely or until it's more in that sort of really bony bad place. And so I think that's an interesting possibility.
Are there any potential downsides to just essentially removing the ability to feel pain in the joint?
Well, so the pain is there so that you know that the joint is damaged. If you know that your joint is damaged and you want to continue to run on it anyway, then are you going to do more damage to your joint? Yes. But are you able to continue to function? Yes. And so it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
So usually how most people are doing it right now is doing it with radio frequency ablation. And so that may not be permanent. So that will last for 6 months, a year. Then it might have to be done again. you can actually surgically remove those nerves, which some people have done sort of for persistent pain after total knee replacement. But that's another surgery to get this done. And so I think the things that are interesting to me are this radiofrequency ablation of these nerves, particularly if people may have arthritis in one part of their knee or another.
I think that's a really great summary. I think that's really useful for a lot of people having questions about when they should be doing what for their joints. So I wanted to kind of switch or change tack slightly and talk about some of your work with the student athletes, which is fascinating to me because I've become a big Husky fan and you're the team physician for the Husky football team. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that involves to sort of be essentially the on-call doctor for this huge revenue sport.
Yeah, it's a great job. I have so happy that I have a job that I love. I basically take care of everything that the football players need. And so a lot of the things that our athletes need are not necessarily musculoskeletal. Sometimes you think, oh my gosh, it's going to be all muscular. But, you know, they get sick, they have coughs, they have colds, depression, anxiety, ADD, everything a normal sort of young adult might encounter, we encounter in the Husky football team. And one of the differences about taking care of these athletes compared to maybe you or I is their schedules are so, so intense that like making an appointment, going to the doctor would never, ever happen. And so I'm there every day after practice and after every game. They can get a hold of me 24/7, literally. And it's sort of the ultimate in sort of concierge care.
Yeah.
And I love doing it. I love being part of the team and keeping these guys back on the field if we can. And also, there's times that it's just not really very smart.
Yeah.
And then working through that, because that's tough when an athlete can't do what they love. I mean, it's like asking somebody not to breathe.
Yeah.
And so trying to make sure that they get back on the field as soon as possible, as quickly as possible, but also keep them safe.
And is there anything in particular that these guys are susceptible to in terms of either diseases? Are they getting sick very frequently because of the frequency of training, or are there other deficiencies or hormonal problems? Is there anything else like that that seems to be cropping up, particularly in football players, or is it just what you'd see in a general college population?
I think it's sort of the general college population, but amplified. And I think really a real challenge for student athletes in general is sleep. These guys get up early in the morning to work out, and then they've got class, and then they come back and they go to meetings. And so actually just getting some time to have a normal sort of social outlet somewhere and then to actually sleep is a real challenge. And something we're looking at sleep as a sort of performance enhancer too. And so you'd like to think that people would just think about it just because of the health and wellness of people in general. But we know now how important sleep is to performance. And so trying to find time to sleep is challenging, I think, for us all, but maybe particularly for these guys.
And how do you handle it? So we talked previously about if you go to an away game, it's in a different state. You come back after the game, you're back at like 5 or 6 in the morning. I wonder, would it be better to like stay there and then come back the next day? Like, how do you balance all of that stuff to sort of their work schedule versus their sort of sporting schedule? How do you kind of find the best way?
Yeah, it's a work in progress. For football in particular, we'd always kick off noon, 1, 2, something like that. And anymore, it seems like most of our kickoffs are in the evening. And so we don't get back till very, very late or early the next morning. And we typically leave right after the game,
yeah,
or about 2 hours after the game by the time media gets done and we get all packed up and loaded onto the plane. So right now, teams are not staying overnight. It seems like that might make some sense for these late kickoffs. You know, that involves logistics and expense, you know, because there's 150 people, 200 people that travel with a football team. So it's a work in progress to try and figure out how to meet multiple demands that you have from media, which creates a lot of revenue, which supports not just the football team, but really big portion of the athletic department. And so it's a challenge.
So I guess a big part of that, you're the chair of the Pac-12 Student Athlete Health and Wellbeing Board, which I know has a reasonably big budget to try and do some research into how to best support student athletes. So even sort of beyond football, is there anything in particular that you think needs to be addressed to sort of improve the health of these guys long term? Guys and girls, I should say.
Yeah, so what we're doing with the Pac-12 is super exciting. So the Pac-12 is giving away $3.5 million worth of grants per year. The research is supposed to benefit the health and wellness of the student athlete. And so what we do, it's like an NIH grant sort of proposal. Different places sort of put forward different grant proposals, and we find ones that we think are good proposals and on our topics of interest, which sleep and wellness is one of them. Mental health is a big thing that we're looking after as well. So I think that maybe we've had some real luck with some conference-wide sort of top-down sort of research projects that we've done. And I think that we may see more of those in the future rather than sort of solicited research, which is tends to be more sort of isolated projects, just because when you put all of the power of the whole Pac-12 together, we can really do some cool things.
So there's some things that you're able to talk about that you guys want to try and implement that you could sort of put over all of these colleges at once, or research that you could try and do across
the first step in that is we've all been on a common injury record. And so we're all using the same program, so we can put it into big database, de-identify it, and look at trends, use it for quality improvement. And that sounds sort of like a simple thing, but the software is expensive. And electronic medical records are great, but they're not easier. They take a lot of effort to sort of get everything into them. And so Pac-12 is funding somebody. It's not just sort of laying it on the shoulders of athletic trainers to do more work because they're already overworked. But we're paying somebody to, as that's part of their job, to get the injury data entered. And then that database will be available for researchers. So if you have a research question, say, what's the stress fracture rate in female cross-country runners in the South versus the North where the sun's different or something like that, you could actually solicit that database and answer that research question.
And what other information are you capable of putting in terms of the highest levels of certain sports? I mean, you have like data on literally everything from an athlete in terms of heart rate variability and blood test data and a whole lot of performance metrics. Is there any sort of central way to get all that data together yet?
Not yet. It's a brave new world in this area of sports analytics. And so we've got all this information coming in and sort of trying to figure out sort of how to use it and how to corral it and all that sort of stuff. Right now in our injury database, all we have is sort of the standard kind of like, did you get hurt? How long did it take you to get back? What part was it? You know, what season was it? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
But certainly we have the potential at some point to be able to put in different, like from sleep quality to the data from the heart rate variability, or even a lot of the load monitors that we use. It would be great to have that all in one place that doesn't exist yet that I know of.
With that kind of infrastructure, hopefully, maybe the Pac-12 can be some of the first to start to think about that, because you know you've got that sort of central body to sort of look at those things, which is very exciting.
Yeah, so we started with the injury stuff, and now we've sort of expanded into, we have sort of concussion, so we're all collecting common concussion variables at certain time points. We're expanding into mental health variables, but yeah, going into analytics, I think, is a big sort of area for opportunity.
Yeah, very cool. I think this has been fabulous. I've really enjoyed picking your brains. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about? Where can people find out about your work if they want to do that?
So I'm here at the Sports Medicine Clinic at the University of Washington. It's a sports medicine clinic at Husky Stadium. If you're interested in anything I'm doing, sort of go to PubMed and look me up there. And I'm always happy to talk to anybody.
We'll put links to all of your papers in the show notes so people can head to the website and grab them there, and we'll put your details of the clinic as well so people can contact you if they need to.
Great, thanks.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right.